Q, what is it that you're trying to tell me?
You'll find out. In any case, I'll be watching. And if you're very lucky, I'll drop by to say hello from time to time. See you out there.
Transfer complete.
Welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge for the 200th time.
Wow. Well, this is Tyler Orton arbitrarily ranking how many episodes we did and just how well they turned out, Cam.
Yes. Well, this week we are going to talk about the best Star Trek episodes.
Wait, are you saying we've done 200 of our own shows and we've never actually tackled this particular topic, Cameron?
Well, you got to hold a topic like this off for the milestones.
Okay. Yeah, I think when we started episode one, we're agreed that we're only going to tackle the best episodes ever if we made it all the way to 200.
Right. We opened our first episode ever was Best Series, and then it took us 200 episodes to get to Best Episodes.
Yeah. I think we've done variations on this, though. But look, I think what you and I determined is we're not going to qualify our picks with, you know, hey, we want to be inclusive of every single series. You know, we want to have equal representation. You and I are just going to it. Saying,
wait, we didn't want to include all the series?
Sorry.
I better cross off all my animated episodes.
Oh, darn.
Half my list was animated.
But what we want to do is just tell people these are the best episodes of Star Trek. We're not saying these are our favorite episodes or these are the ones that we like watching on a rainy day. We're saying unequivocally, no arguments at all. You must abide by our ruling here. These are the best episodes of Star Trek. So we hope to rattle a few cages here. Some of our longtime listeners who may disagree with us, which is great. Sending those angry letters as Cam rattles off all of his TAS episode picks. But
it was tough because when I was looking at the lists, you know, trying to come out, because of course I did research. I looked at a lot of top episode lists and then was comparing it to my own. And it is really interesting to me, you know, there's so many great episodes of the series, and how many would fall in my top 20 or my 25 or whatever, and you're like, boy, it's a lot more damning to narrow it down to 10, because then people are like, how could you leave off this, when maybe that's my number 15.
You and I were actually even floating the idea that we just do a top 5 list, and I think
that would have been insane.
Well, we both realized just how difficult that was going to be,
and
so what we're going to do, we're going to a bit of a different format, though, because you listen to a lot of podcasts that do these episode rankings or movie rankings or album rankings, and a lot of them, they overlap their picks, so by the time you get to the number one pick, well, you've already kind of exhausted your discussion on that if your podcasting partner picked that within the first 5 minutes of the show. So what we're going to do is reveal our episodes through alphabetical, and then at the end of the episode, we're actually going to reveal how we rank them overall. So you want to stay tuned to the very end to hear how Cam and I have determined with complete absolute certainty what the rankings are.
Yeah, you cannot move these things one slot up or one slot down. This is where they belong for all of time.
It is now canon.
Until episode 400 when we revise our lists.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, Cam, why don't we start with you? You do the first episode in your alphabetical order, and then we'll throw over to me, and I'll do my next episode in alphabetical order, and we'll just go back and forth. We've got 20 episodes that we have all together, but I suspect there's going to be some overlap, so it'll be fun once we get to the end and we actually do our rankings here. And that's where the real fun's going to be.
Okay.
So, sorry for all those people who are going to have to sit through an hour and a half of us not having real fun.
Right. Okay, so my first entry in the alphabetical list is Balance of Terror from the original series. I actually really did play around with whether or not to keep this one in the top 10 or have it as a runner-up. I knew it was very important, but there's so many to choose from. And again, people at home will be screaming into their headsets as to what was left off. But to me, this was an episode that was so important just from the Romulans, but also storytelling. I mean, you know what really sold this episode for me?
Tell me, Cam.
Was that, first off, it's a hugely dramatic you know, dynamic episode with great chemistry with Kirk and his crew, and then also the Romulan cast, you know, just two fantastic ensembles working opposite. But what sells it for me is the moment at the end of the episode where Kirk walks into that hallway exhausted. And I remember feeling, every time I've watched it, like I am completely in Kirk's head in that moment. Like, yeah. I feel the same way when the episode ends. And to me, Trek, it's very easy, I think, to look at a lot of the, say, really, really genius high concept episodes and be like, that's a great episode because the high concept was done well. But for me personally, what makes the episodes, you know, an all-timer is if there's also an emotional connection. And I feel like on the edge of my seat and so emotionally invested in both sides of the conflict and Balance of Terror. So for me, that was what makes it so important. And just the idea that we can empathize with both sides, which is very, very, very Star Trek.
Kirk's exhaustion, was it just something relatable? Did it help kind of reaffirm the fact that these aren't always just superhuman beings? Yeah. They are just real people?
Because often Kirk would be, you know, people like to underline Kirk as like the action hero guy who can punch out the alien and then be like, well, you know, and pick up the female alien of the week or what have you. But, you know, you really get to see the humanity of Kirk here, where it's like, yeah, this is a big quote-unquote glorious war situation, but he doesn't walk out like, rah-rah, guys, on to the next mission. He's like he's spent.
Would this episode have worked as well had it not been for Mark Leonard's portraying the Romulan commander, though? What was his casting key, or do you think it was right there on the page the whole time?
I mean, this episode is brilliantly scripted, but I do think Mark Leonard, I mean, we saw it just with his Sarek performances, like that man can elevate anything, because not every single Sarek appearance was brilliantly written. But he just always can take material and just make it sound. I mean, I don't know his background that formal. Like, was he a Shakespearean actor?
He's got kind of the theatrical voice.
He does.
You know, but I don't know if that necessarily means Shakespeare.
Right. But he just has that ability to invest all of these words. I mean, I guess like Nimoy or Patrick Stewart also, the ability to just take these words and just give them so much meaning and weight, where you never feel like you're seeing him kind of phoning it in or just. You know, in that era, there's so many actors who are just being popped from TV series to TV series to TV series, depending on the week. He does not feel like that type. It feels like he was really practicing for this role.
So you said this is a very important episode, and you're highlighting maybe part of the evolution was with regards to the Romulans. You also mentioned the story, the character stuff. But just from, I guess, a society perspective, though, mm-hmm. This is an episode about people being bigots, people
right.
discriminating
yeah.
against each other. How well do you think this plays in the 1960s during a very tumultuous time in history versus, well, 52 years later, where it's still a very tumultuous time in history right now? But is this the type of episode that it's kind of made to last for maybe another 50 years as well?
It feels like a timeless episode. And you think of how daring it was, too, coming out in the 60s at the time of the Cold War. And it's saying, you know, both sides have positive sides to them. Like, they are good people embroiled in a very ugly conflict, but they both have dignity and they both deserve respect.
I was even thinking about it more along kind of the racial lines
sure.
within, like,
yeah.
the United
no,
States.
Definitely.
And we have that one, was it Lieutenant Riley that was the one that was...
It's not Riley. I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
But it was the one lieutenant who was very much discriminating against Spock, of all people.
Right.
Because how can I trust this person who, you know, he's different from me? And I think there's just something pretty spectacular and timeless about this one that I think
right.
it's endured for 50 years. I hope that people 50 years from now can appreciate just the way that, you know, cinematic television was, you know, at the time.
Right.
So, Cam, first up on my list, alphabetically, I think you knew I was going to have to hit this one, but All Good Things.
Right.
From Star Trek. Well, I hope everybody knows it's from Star Trek. Yeah. From Star Trek The Next Generation.
That classic Babylon 5 episode.
But I no, it's Sequest, DSV.
Hello, it's Darwin.
I like how it's episode 200 and you and I still have not matured
no.
one iota.
Yeah. But, we've actually gone backwards.
Yeah, that's true.
It's like that episode Genesis. We're just like going backwards in evolution.
See, I was originally thinking maybe Rascals.
Oh,
but,
okay.
Yeah, I
sure.
can see the Genesis connection
Either
there. Are you... Monkey Ogawa, or are you Troy the Fish?
Fish Troy.
Fish Troy?
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Gotcha. But all good...
if I'm doing dolphin impressions, I mean, that's the closest thing.
Okay, gotcha. But this is just one of the best series finales ever. I'm not talking about
yeah.
within Star Trek canon. I'm
yeah.
talking about within television history.
That and Golden Girls, yeah.
what happened on the Golden Girls finale?
Dorothy married Leslie Nielsen.
Oh, well, good for her. I can't wait for that reboot. Anyway, with regards to Star Trek The Next Generation, all good things. The finale is something that's tied so much into the setting as it is the characters. And by setting, I'm talking about how we're experiencing the adventures of the Enterprise over the 7-year journey, and that we see Picard on the ship when it had those old 1980s wood panelings, and he's also interacting with a crew through 3 different time periods as well. Right. You see where people started, you see where people are, and you see where they could possibly go. And it makes you, as an audience member, engaged with everything you've experienced at this point. And also, you've got the callbacks to everything from that Trial for Humanity that mm-hmm. Q is observing and presiding over. And we also have, I think, like one of the strongest Q stories that we ever experienced here, where he is just on fire with what he does best. But, I mean, for me, it's one of the moments that I think sticks with me that I can remember when I saw it, like, when it aired. But it was when Picard blinks, he's in a shuttle, and there's Tasha Yar.
Right.
We've seen the actress, we've seen the character as audience members. Picard literally has not seen her in more than 6 years at this point, and it stuns him. And it really takes you into that kind of emotional connection that he has with his crew. And by the time we get to the last scene where he finally goes and joins that poker tourney or that poker game that they're playing, I think he realizes this is his family. He needs to make it work no matter what. And for him, it's never as if he felt unwelcome.
Right.
It's he didn't feel as necessarily appropriate for him.
Right.
And I think, you know, we've talked about how different Picard is in the movies versus the TV show. Maybe this last Q jaunt was kind of the thing that kind of turned him around, and we got action hero Picard moving forward.
That's the nicest way to justify it.
I would hope so. But I mean, for you, like, I mean, you must have, even if you didn't watch the finale when it aired, Cam.
Yeah.
You must have heard, you know, how great it was.
I think I did watch it when it aired.
Oh, okay.
Not necessarily, you know, the night it aired, but I think I taped it and watched it like the next day.
Well, tell me just about your reactions to it, maybe how your reactions have changed, if at all, or did it still... I don't know.
It definitely felt very powerful to me the first time I saw it, but I don't think I had the appreciation that a fan would have had who's gone through that 7-year journey and experienced all these character moments. Like, I very much enjoyed it, but it wasn't, like, to me, the knockout punch. It was later when I watched it, when I revisited it, you know, a few handful of years ago.
Yeah. Did you also feel as if you had that kind of moment to experience, like, another 20 years of TV to see how hard it is to really stick the landing for a lot of these TV series?
It's really
series.
Tough, because I can think of a lot of shows with really great endings where I walked away going like, wow, you know, that series held up right to the bitter end. But with this one, it really felt like they didn't just end it in a very satisfying way. They just like hit a total home run of we are going to produce the best episode of the entire season. And a lot of shows don't do that. You know, like Breaking Bad is a great example. Like, I think the finale is actually really good. But 2 episodes before that one is the best episode, maybe, of the series.
Yep.
And so, you know, that's just the way it goes for a lot of shows. But I think All Good Things has something that, you know, I just referred to a few minutes ago. The idea that, like, it's a very complicated conceptual episode. And you could just deliver that concept incredibly well. And people would be like, man, that was really well done. I enjoyed that a lot. But it's the emotion of that 2-parter that I think really gives it that extra push. I think Star Trek is often dismissed a little bit emotionally. People go, well, it's very cerebral. It's about smart people sure. doing smart things and, you know, these high concept settings. But to me, it's the emotion that ultimately is that extra little push towards what makes Star Trek matter. And that is, like, it does inspire people. You know, Star Trek wouldn't necessarily inspire people if it was entirely cerebral.
Because there's be this certain aloofness to it, and you just couldn't be able to connect to it. What was maybe your favorite scene from this? I mean, there's so many iconic things going on here, but is there one moment that maybe stands out to you?
I mean, to me, I think it's pretty easy to say, and that is Picard coming in at the very end to the card table.
Yeah.
It just ends that journey on such a beautiful note. Just the execution of that shot turning into the Enterprise D, you know, is just beautifully done. It's very 2001, actually, Space Odyssey. And I mean, it's, as you said, it is one of the all-time great finales. And I'm very pleased to see that a lot of TV critics mention that too, because sometimes Star Trek's kind of put in a little bit of a ghetto in terms of TV. Like, they're like, well, that's just, you know, the genre show, but you got to look at the prestige shows for the greatness.
Yeah.
I do like that All Good Things is often recognized by mainstream TV critics as a very important 2 hours of television.
But what I've noticed just in recent years, though, is critics have been kind of giving it its due recently. I think people are, maybe it's something that they can go back and look fondly at, and then they can actually appreciate how well it stood the test of time. I'll tell you, Cam, I'm watching the Blu-rays, and I'm just in awe about how a show that's 25 years old doesn't have like this aged feel that you get from a lot of these, like Miami Vice, if I watched it today, right?
But why are you dressed like Crockett right now then?
I've been dressing like this since Miami Vice was on the air, Cam. I think you would know that about me by now.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. But so, Cam, what's next on your list here?
Okay, well, I've got another TNG one to follow you up, and that's Best of Both Worlds Part 1.
Not Part 2?
Well, you know what?
Well, let's get into that.
Best episode. Okay. I decided to split up the two-parters because it did feel dishonest to mention the whole thing. I think Best of Both Worlds Part 1, first off, is far superior to Part 2.
I'm absolutely 100% behind you on that.
What I love about this episode is that, first off, we've talked about it in the past. This is a genius Riker story where you have him deciding whether he wants to move on from the Enterprise D, and you have him quarreling with Shelby, and Shelby's this dynamic character on her own, but you bring in the Borg for their finest hour in any of the Star Trek series, and to me, this is Star Trek doing blockbuster entertainment. Like, TV in the 80s could not compete with film, just because of budget levels alone, but to me, this is like Star Trek figuring out...
I mean, Golden Girls did.
Well, that one aside, you know, they had the money, I guess.
Well, they went all out on the finale, at least.
Of course, Leslie Nielsen. Yeah. But, you know, this is Star Trek realizing what makes blockbusters popular, and it's not necessarily the effects budgets. Like, to me, I look at Best of Both Worlds, and I see the type of storytelling you see, like, George Lucas doing in Empire Strikes Back.
Just that sense of scale?
Yeah, there's the scale and the way the characters are behaving in there throughout the episode. It's like there's an elevated... like intensity to it, like
intention.
Yeah,
it's very much high stakes.
Like, I mean, it ultimately is really, really genius soap opera storytelling that involves you on an emotional level, but it's, you know, heightened to a level that it's not realistic, but you are totally drawn into this heightened drama, and you cannot wait to see what happens next. You know, Empire Strikes Back is regularly regarded as the greatest Star Wars movie. Return of the Jedi is not usually held up as the second best. And I think Best of Both Worlds, for me, you know, the first part is one of the greatest Star Trek episodes of all time, but I don't think Best of Both Worlds Part 2 is in the running.
Yeah, no, I agree with that assessment there. For me, the other thing about Star Trek that I always appreciated is that the characters are using their smarts, whether it's diplomacy or science, to get out of problems. What happens when they fail?
Right.
That's what happens here with Picard, is he fails utterly in this, and it's a scary result by the end of the episode, which creates... let's be honest, it might go down as the best cliffhanger that Star Trek's ever done. You and I can kind of debate, you know, part of that. But I think if you polled fans, and if you polled a lot of TV critics out there, this is going to rank very high just amongst cliffhangers of all time that have ever aired on TV. So, I mean, this is just such a fantastically made episode. The other thing that I want to zero in on, and you mentioned it as well, but the dynamic going on between Riker and Shelby, in which we do have a Starfleet officer creating a lot of internal conflict. The fact that she just came out with guns a-blazing and the character works so well, it's disappointing to me when I'm on Facebook and people are posting about how much they like Shelby as a character, and you got a lot of like knuckle draggers saying like they hate her, and they don't ever really explain why.
People are being creepy on the internet and being jerks.
I know, but the thing is, if you look at that character, you have so much appreciation for what she... offered to this episode, and I don't think this episode would have necessarily worked on so many different levels if not for Elizabeth Dennehy's performance as that character. So I love it when we have the characters facing this internal conflict. She literally says to Riker, I want your job. Why don't you go captain another ship? That's stuff that I love. And she's impulsive, impetuous. It's stuff that reminds Riker of a younger Riker, too.
Right.
This, to me, might be the best, William Riker episode. We only have, like, two contenders for best Tom Riker episodes, so.
I love when they introduce, in these two-parters, a new character who feels fully formed out of the gate. Like, we've, you know, complained in the past about the villain in Gambit and how one-note he is, but, like,
What's his name?
I don't remember. Yeah, that's why I said the villain. But, you know, you look at Shelby, or you even look at Jellicoe in Chain of Command. Like, these characters show up fully formed, you get a real sense of who they are, and you can totally invest in them, even if you don't necessarily like them, but they feel like real characters. They don't feel like just pop-in guest stars.
And those are the ones that I just hate. It's because I don't know what they want. They just seem so cardboard cutouts, like they're just to create conflict, but they have no motivation behind it. And so that's why, like, a Shelby or a Jellicoe, they work so well. Even, like, well, let's stick with Chain of Command. You get Gul Madred.
Yeah.
You don't agree with his methods, but you get a character like that. And I think having, like, a good antagonist, and Shelby's not a villain.
No.
But she is a little bit antagonistic towards Riker, and we have somebody like that.
Right.
Just like how Jellicoe's antagonistic towards Riker. Riker's got a problem with authority, doesn't he? Yeah.
Just a little. And I like how, you know, with the cliffhanger moment, you suddenly see it's Riker and Shelby standing side by side, facing down Picard.
Yeah.
And I like that, you know, look, you can almost imagine an alternate future where the next episode, Picard has gone evil and they have to take him down. And these two are going to have to work together in the future. And this would be a great origin story of their relationship. So it works in any way you look at it.
Yeah. If only we could experience another 5 seasons of that Parallels universe. That,
no kidding.
We got to see Riker really grow that beard out. Yeah. So, next on my list here, going in alphabetical order, this is one that I don't think pops up on as many top 10 lists as it really should. And it bums me out because I think it is... Well, it's obviously one of the top 10 best episodes of Star Trek, but Call to Arms from Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
This is really, I think, the one episode of Star Trek where it's been building to for 5 years, and it's firing in all cylinders, and everything here, it's about emotional investments and what's been going on throughout all the characters. And I think, yeah, we can get to the brilliance of the baseball that Sisko leaves behind here, but to me, part of the brilliance is you understand where the characters are being left off in their different journeys.
Mm-hmm.
One realm, Jadzia and Worf, they're being torn apart, but they are closer than ever before because Jadzia says, yeah, let's get married. I know that's what you always wanted. We have Rom and Lita that are getting married at this point, and Sisko's embracing his role as emissary to do so.
Yeah.
And guess what? They're going to be going through some very strange times ahead because Rom's going undercover as a waiter once more.
Right.
It's just amazing. Even like the Sisko and or the Ben and Jake separation there. There's so many things that are set up. I've never been more excited to see where the series goes after this. Anytime I've watched a finale here, Cam, mm-hmm. and let's just be honest. This one does not work if not for Gul Dukat's return to Deep Space Nine, and just
right.
that stroll he takes down yeah. the half-destroyed promenade.
Right, and then, of course, the baseball moment, which is an all-time great moment.
Well, did it strike you right away, no pun intended,
yes.
with regards to baseball?
Yes, it did.
It was Definitely. Just something that, like, you think about, and we did our, you know, most badass moments in Star Trek. That, to me, is just one of the most badass things you ever see, and the fact that, you know, Dukat left it there.
Yeah,
I think that's very telling about his own hubris and ego as well. He wanted it as a trophy.
Right.
He never really got to do that. He did get to hand it back to Sisko by the end of that arc, though.
Yeah, when I watched this episode, I just remember, look, I was enjoying Deep Space Nine so much at this point in time, but I just remember when that cliffhanger hit, just being like, I have to finish this. Like, I have to keep going because it was just the most dynamic storytelling I think I'd ever seen on Star Trek. Now, that's not to say it's the greatest episode of all time, but it's an episode that to me has so much momentum and really just hammers home like how great this show can be when it's firing on all cylinders and how it can be better than almost any other show on the air.
But I think it's also, you bring up the word important when we're talking about Balance of Terror.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's also a very important episode for just Deep Space Nine lore in
okay.
that like
yeah.
it shows you what this series is capable of,
right.
you know, and I think the fact that from there we get pretty much, it's not an unending arc, but there, it's where this is what the rest of the series is going to be. It almost as if the series reinvents itself to a certain degree. I know that they don't occupy Tarak Nor for the remainder of the series,
right.
but it's like, no, the series now is about the Dominion War. It has very tough consequences on the characters moving forward,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that we're so like psyched for the setup and then it continues to pay off, you know, I think this is just such a fantastic build up to everything we've been waiting for
yeah.
for 5 years.
And you know, this could easily be an episode of just like cool cliffhanger moments,
mm-hmm.
but to me it's the character stuff that just makes you that much more invested. Yeah, as you said, you know, Rom and Lita, like there is a real sense of these characters and how much we care for them at this point. And it's an episode that I actually find it's almost difficult to recommend to people because it's a show you almost have to watch the entirety of Deep Space Nine to really care as much about it as it deserves.
I would never recommend this to a novice fan.
Yeah.
It just because, you know, it would be disappointing for me to hear back from them and they'd be like, yeah, it's okay. I'm like, well,
yeah.
you haven't been watching it for 5 years, though.
Yeah, like I don't have a lot of episodes on my list that I feel that way about, but Call to Arms is kind of that. Maybe even that one special episode that stands out is like, well, you kind of have to watch the whole thing, but nothing's better than Call to Arms.
But then that's what kind of Deep Space Nine built itself around. So that's why, to me, like, a lot of the episodes that I picked here, I think, yeah, there are episodes you can give to, you know, novice fans. And,
sure.
You know, this, to me, is kind of the epitome of Deep Space Nine, and it stands for a reason. I mean, look, if you're going to be a little bit lost in it, you need to be invested in this five-year journey. So that's why this one totally works. And I think it's a legit, you know, number 10 of all time episode.
And, you know, however Discovery turns out in the long run, when people talk about Discovery, it will be hard to separate a lot of those episodes as well. So, you know, DS9 was just ahead of the curve in that regard.
I'll be able to separate C.V. Pockham Parabellum from the rest of them, Cam.
Saru running. Okay, well, next on my list is Chain of Command Part 2.
Interesting.
I love both parts, but Part 2, with the introduction of Gul Madred at the very end of Part 1, he takes over with Part 2. And this, you know, is the ultimate Picard story, one of the greatest of all time, where it's the, you know, how many lights are there, and the him being tortured under Gul Madred. We've talked a lot about this two-parter on this podcast, and I think that's for a reason. This is definitely Picard pushed harder than I think we ever see him on the show. We do see Picard, you know, tormented in a number of episodes, but never like this, and never to the point where...
Yeah, remember when he had to sit through Data's poetry reading?
Or perform Shakespeare with him?
Yeah.
Or when Data was judging his painting? But... yeah, like, to me, this is Picard. I mean, he's not quite broken, but he's so, so close.
Yes.
And to me, you know, it's not as flashy as, say, Best of Both Worlds. Like, we can see Picard is shattered by his experience with Locutus, but that looks pretty cool. Like, let's be honest. You know, Patrick Stewart in Borg makeup looks cool. There's nothing cool about what Picard goes through in Chain of Command.
Well, it's dehumanizing, and you feel that on the screen.
And it feels... like adult, you know. I mean, TNG is definitely, I think, maybe a little more adult than a lot of the other Star Trek series,
such as the animated series.
Oh no, that's the most adult. Oh, but but to me, this feels like elevated that extra bit more. Like, this feels like adult storytelling, and done incredibly well, and very sophisticated, and holds up brilliantly all these years later.
But it's very interesting you delineate between parts one and part two, because the thing is, when we rewatched it semi recently, we had forgotten how much of part one dealt with splunking through caves.
Yeah, which is, to me, the weakest part of that two-parter.
Like, in my brain, like, I imagine this two-parter is Picard in a torture chamber for 2 hours. And then when that actually happens, it's really just part two.
Yeah.
And we also get, and we alluded to it earlier with the Chain of Command discussion, but we also get some of the best...
You mean Best of Both Worlds discussion?
Oh, when we were discussing Chain of Command earlier today, or earlier on the show, we were talking about Riker and Jellicoe. Yeah. And... this is some of the best Riker stuff that that character's. So even though it's like a very much Picard-centric episode, Riker's kind of on fire too.
I like how these two-parters that we've talked about give, you know, the first officer a lot to do and really dynamic stuff. It reminds me a lot of Voyager, where you see Chakotay only really come alive in these two-parters. It's like they find these two-parters and are like, okay, let's really give the first officer among the most dynamic material they're going to get in the entirety of the series. And yeah, this Riker-Jellicoe storyline is just dynamite.
I love it. Okay, so next up on my list, Cam, I'm kind of surprised we haven't gone to this one yet, but it's maybe the... Well, I guess it's because it's alphabetical. Yeah.
You're like The Visitor.
Yeah. City on the Edge of Forever.
Yeah.
You know, how can this not be on anybody's top 10 list? You know, because we keep going back to what makes Star Trek work. And from this one, okay, you love the sci-fi tropes, you love the characters, you love, I guess, the story as well. And I think this might be one of the most, like, well, I'll say this all out. We've had flings of the week with captains and all that. I think this is the most successful, like, romance one-off story that we ever saw, and what you feel the pain.
Some would even argue the best romance in the entirety of Star Trek.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that's the Cassidy Yates Ben Sisko relationship is very important to the series, but did you feel as if it was a romance for the ages necessarily?
Well, maybe on Star Trek, because a lot of them are pretty bad.
Yeah,
but
that's true.
But Jadzia Worf, I think, is the one people would hold up the most.
Yeah,
it just depends. A lot of people don't like Deep Space Nine. Would point more towards this episode.
Yeah, but this one, I mean, you've got everything going for it that really makes Star Trek work, and I just have to believe that. If we're gonna put an episode of the original series into, like, a time capsule. Mm-hmm. I think more than a few people are probably selecting this one. There's a reason why this one often pops up. Always pops up in, yeah, you know, top 10 lists, top 5 lists, often like number 1 lists as right. well. So to me, I mean, if I'm thinking about what I love about TOS, it usually comes back to the character dynamics. And the one weakness here is that McCoy is kind of split off from the triumvirate.
Sure.
But what we get with just...
Assassins.
That's pretty amazing now, yeah. McCoy stuff, though. But what we get with the Spock and Kirk dynamic, especially with Spock interacting with Depression-era Earth.
Yeah.
I mean, it's also... It has its lighter moments, too, mm-hmm. for such a heavy...
It's very funny. It's very dramatic. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, to me, this is just such a great episode. And I can't fault anybody, well, especially myself, since I'm including it on a top 10 list. But I can't fault anybody for including it on a top 10 list.
And we should note it was co-written by Harlan Ellison. It was heavily rewritten, as he often pointed out. But he just passed on like last week. So it's very, you know, I think it's a cool idea that we've done this episode. And it kind of ties into that. Because Harlan Ellison, I mean, he was a great writer. And, you know, if you ever saw him at a Star Trek con, you'd never forget it. He was a heck of a personality.
Cam, you and I loved his panels,
He might be the best Star Trek panel I've ever seen at a convention.
He was incredibly cantankerous and curmudgeon-y, but you kind of felt he was putting on a bit of an act because he knew that's, you know, why be boring in life, you know? And the fact that we only saw him that one year... And a number of panels, and we're still talking about them when we have discussions with our friends. I don't know how many other panels we're still discussing 5 years later.
Yeah.
And the very fact is, even when we're in a Starbucks and he's like snapping at our friends, you know, making like remarks, and he came back to our friends and was trying to kind of make amends, be like, oh, no. So it's like, you know, the guy was as genius as he was, there's something like good within him.
Definitely. Yeah.
I wrote his eulogy.
And, you know, if anyone didn't know, you can buy a graphic novel of his original version of City on the Edge of Forever. Very different, but you can see a lot of the same concepts in that graphic novel. But to me, one thing that I think a lot of the episodes on my list have is that they don't feel like an hour of television. They feel like they've taken me on a journey that could be compared up against, like, Lawrence of Arabia. Like, it's an epic. Like, when it's over, I feel like I've just gone on this amazing journey, regardless of how long it was, because usually when people say epic, they think 3 hours or whatever, you know, Titanic, that sort of thing. But to me, like, the hour just feels, it doesn't feel like another installment in a series. It feels like this almost like standalone hour that just took me someplace I never would have ever seen. And I leave just like, wow, just completely in awe of it. And this episode falls really into that category for me.
Well, it's funny for me because I often have that feeling for TOS episodes much more than other series where there is that kind of epicness to it. And this is not one that would necessarily make it onto any of my top 10 lists, but Metamorphosis also reminds me of that kind of journey that you're describing. Yeah, it does.
No, that's a good one.
Where even though it seems like a smaller scale of an episode where it's, you know, crash land on a planet, I just think about like all the places that we took emotionally for that journey within that like one set, or I guess there's two sets involved there. So I just have to give so many props to what TOS was able to accomplish, you know, at the time. And the thing is, like, they're not doing it with benefit of all the history or 2020 hindsight or anything like that. They're just doing it within the moment, and they're catching lightning in a bottle in just such this magnificent way. Because this is a very tumultuous time making this particular episode. And you mentioned the script issues. And so I wonder how much they knew they had something great while they're doing it, or if it just came out that way in the end through sheer luck.
Yeah. And just the casting of Joan Collins, she's a great actress, but you never know what you're going to get when you put, you know, an actress up against William Shatner. You know, sometimes great actors, you put two of them together and they fizzle. Like, it just doesn't work. You know, watch like the movie The Tourist with Johnny Depp and Angelina Jolie. They look bored out of their minds through the entirety of that movie, even though they're both hugely talented actors.
Yeah.
But the combo of Shatner and Joan Collins is just incredible. Like, it's a type of thing you hope for when you're making any sort of romance. You know, you just wish you could have actors with that level of chemistry. And they are just so, so unforgettable together. And it's, you know, that romance is the reason this episode continues to wow people.
Well, what did you think of the Star Trek panel that we saw just a few years ago with Shatner and Collins?
I really enjoyed that a lot. And it was fun to see that they have, you can tell there's a real respect between the two of them. And I think that respect comes across in the episode. It doesn't feel like Shatner kind of slumming with another actor. Like, it feels like this is someone who's a peer of his and he's going to work and collaborate with very strongly.
Yeah.
Because you would see later, you know, in lots of Star Trek episodes, they would cast young actresses who had very limited experience. And, you know, I'm sure in certain cases, Shatner was kind of like, okay, I'm going to have to carry this one a little more than other weeks, you know? But it didn't feel like that with this story.
I don't think we give Shatner enough credit for his acting chops. I know it's easy for people to go into 1980s Shatner where, you know, he's hamming it up to a certain degree. But really, he's a stage actor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he really takes that to the screen in his performances. And a lot of the stage acting is maybe, as you say, like carry the weight, find the chemistry that works, find something in the moment that's going to work, and get it across screen in a very, well, dramatic way, of course.
Right.
But I mean, I really think that we need to praise Shatner's acting abilities just because I think he's unfairly maligned, even amongst the fans a lot of the time.
Right. I mean, his public persona is a little prickly, and I can see why a lot of fans maybe turn on him a little bit, but I think when you actually look at the evidence on screen, which I think is the most important thing when you're judging the character, and I think, you know, the proof is right there when you watch those great original series episodes. And actually, I'm going to jump for my next one to an original series episode, and that's the Corbomite Maneuver, which for me, I think what I love about this episode is this is maybe the first episode where I feel the magic of Star Trek. And that these are characters who are going into space. And, you know, it kind of plays out a little bit like Balance of Terror, where it has that high level of tension of what are they dealing with? What is this strange alien craft? You know, it's very threatening towards them. But ultimately, it's about what happens when you embrace the best of humanity and, you know, show a good face and don't necessarily get scared or run back or get violent. Like, you know, ultimately, they meet Baylock and it's this small baby man. But it's all about these characters.
That's my nickname in high school.
It's all about these characters embracing what's important about humanity and taking that extra step forward. And I think it's the first episode in the series that really justifies why we need to be out there and why we need to keep going. And so for me, like when I look at the spirit of Star Trek, I really think this episode embodies all of it. And, you know, you get amazing character dynamics. Like there's just scenes of McCoy talking to Kirk, sharing a drink, you know, a scene they echoed in Star Trek Beyond. And it's just like the rich characters and just a world with infinite possibilities. And these characters are always going to go into it and hopefully let optimism guide them.
How significant is it that this was meant to be essentially our introduction to Star Trek? This was meant to be the first episode we ever saw. That's not how it turned out.
Right. The man trap. We got the man trap instead.
At least it wasn't Miri.
That's true.
Yeah. But just with regards to, I guess, what the creators knew going in, what the actors could probably feel, you know, with character dynamics between them, how significant is it that this is kind of a series that kind of knew where it could go so early on?
Right. No, yeah, exactly. I mean, it definitely feels fully formed almost right out of the gate. And I love a lot how, you know, the original series and some of the other series were not good about this. The ugly alien problem we've talked about. You know, we see in this episode, we also see in Arena, they would come back to this theme on the original series of these aliens that looked very scary, how we can't let that scare us. Like, we have to figure out who they are and what they mean and what they represent. And they do that with Baylock in this episode. I don't think they maybe ever do it better than in this episode. At least that's my argument.
Yeah, no, a very valid argument.
Okay? Yeah, yeah.
All right, next on my list here, and I think this might surprise some people, and I swear I'm not trying to make one of these, like, lists that are meant to just rankle people for no reason.
Life support.
No, I mean, they're my favorite moment ever at the very end, Cam.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway. No, In a Mirror Darkly from Star Trek Enterprise. To me, I've never had such a turnaround on the way I felt about a Star Trek series, and that, like, I gave up on Star Trek after two seasons of Enterprise. I think I was just one of those fans that was feeling oversaturated. You and fallen comrade Benjamin Yong convinced me to go back and watch Enterprise. By the time I got to the end of season 4, and they're doing episodes like In a Mirror Darkly, I was devastated, not because it was a bad episode, because it was just such a fantastic episode that reverse engineered everything that was wrong with those early seasons, the issues that I had with the characters, and then made it into one of the most fan-servicey things ever that really would not have worked had you not really known those characters so well and some of the problems that they had with kind of, let's be honest, you know, Mayweather and Hoshi were not exactly the most dynamic, but you give Hoshi so much fantastic stuff. You give her agency, really, for more than she's ever experienced. You turn her into the Empress. you actually just seem to give Mayweather a widow's peak and a earring, and right. he's all of a sudden like this awesome space pirate. I say, you know, maybe would not have worked so well had you not been familiar with the characters, but, and I'm not dividing this between parts one and two, by the way. I'm going in a mirror darkly, parts one and two.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I think this actually stands on its own, though, and it's designed to do so. Yeah. It sets it up with the teaser, which kind of brilliant with the Zefram Cochrane blasting Vulcans with a shotgun during first contact.
Yeah.
You get these...
The opening credits are great.
The opening credits kind of explain what happens throughout history. And then you've got this kind of standalone story that is seemingly disconnected from the rest of the Star Trek universe until you go back and you're introduced to the USS Defiant, not from Deep Space Nine, but from the original series, from the Tholian Web. And you're like, oh, wow, this is actually something that cares deeply about the mythology of Star Trek. And I think it's just so brilliant on Manny Kota's part to really make me appreciate everything that had come before on Enterprise. So even if I had problems with the series, I could love an episode like this. There's other episodes out there that are very fun, but this one, to me, I was just blown away. Like, I was getting to the end of all the episodes of Star Trek that I've really not experienced yet at that point. And for me, In a Mirror Darkly was just a fantastic experience.
You know, people don't look at Enterprise as a creatively daring or innovative show. They tend to put it in a bit of a category, say next to Voyager, where they're like, whether, you know, they like it or not, they're like, well, it's, you know, the storytelling is not up to TNG or DS9 or the shows that came before.
Yeah.
But I think it's really important to underline this two-parter that you mentioned in a Mirror Darkly, as this is one of the greatest Mirror Universe stories of all time. We can argue back and forth whether it's better than Mirror Mirror, mm-hmm. but it's better than any of the Mirror Universe episodes of Deep Space Nine.
I agree.
And I mean, Deep Space Nine is held up usually as a better series than Enterprise. So it shows you that Enterprise, you know, if they could just have figured their stuff out earlier, they could have had a show right from the early days that really held up as amazing Star Trek.
I think if
it just took so long to get there.
If we just started with the Zindi War, if that was the instigating, you know, part of the series that jump started our viewing into it, I think that we could have really captured a lot more audiences just in sheer numbers. And, and if we kept going with the storylines that we saw in season four and so on and so forth, I mean, it is a bummer. It took them two seasons to figure things out. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a different era of TV at the time. So
if you had episodes like this in season one, I think people would have agreed with what the hype was, that this is not like the previous series.
Yeah.
The problem was they hyped that it was not like the other series that had come before. But it looked a lot like Voyager.
And it felt a lot like Voyager.
Yeah.
So, what's next up for you, Cameron?
Okay, well, next on my list is one I don't think anyone will be surprised to hear mentioned, and that's The Inner Light.
Okay.
This is, of course, the episode where Picard has, you know, a whole other lifetime, thanks to an alien buoy. And, I mean, you know, I talked earlier about the emotion of Star Trek. This is one of the all-time great emotional stories for Picard. And I love stories that feel like they are going over a long period of time and you are getting to see an entire lifetime. I love movies like that, and I love, you know, a Star Trek episode like this where it all feels like it works even though you're seeing it in, what, 45 minutes? You know, like, that's really tough to do. I don't know if people realize how tough it is to show an entire lifetime in 45 minutes and still have each beat of the story work on an emotional level.
Well, the thing is, each beat, each little time span, it actually needs to tell a story in and of itself.
Yeah.
And for that to only cover 3 to 5 pages
at
each point, that is extremely difficult to do.
Yeah.
It's all there right on the page, of course, but how much does it... Okay. I know this seems a little reductive on my part, but how much does the musical cue, the very famous musical cue,
it's
sell
big.
This episode? Like, I think if you've got like a kazoo noise, I mean, obviously it's going to be a bummer to listen to, but I mean, there's just something about the aesthetics of Star Trek. Star Trek was not really known for its dynamic TV scores.
Sure.
This, to me, is something, there's a reason why this is so iconic. If it was attached to a lesser episode, I don't think it would have stuck around in the fans' minds the same way.
Well, it's like, you know, the movie Jaws. Take away the John Williams score, what do you get? Like, who knows, right? But it definitely is probably not going to be the huge, massive, gargantuan hit that it was.
Yep.
You know, that score can be so important to making it a story as effective as it is. And yeah, the music in Inner Light is so beautiful, and I am so happy I've gotten to hear it performed live multiple times now by an orchestra. And just this story, I mean,
Well, let's think about this story. It's we know Picard as a scientist, as the explorer,
yeah,
but not as a family man.
Yeah.
And what if he's forced
Or just a man in his life, like, yeah, you know, going through those intimate emotions. You know, a lot of the show is about captain decisions and things like that. Yeah.
But what if he's forced over a number of years to submit to that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've never really seen Picard in this situation before. And we see him uncomfortable in his own skin,
right,
as we've seen many a times. And then over the course of, like, moments, like, you know, 15 minutes, we actually buy into the idea that he's got a family that he loves and cares about. And he's still pursuing those scientific endeavors.
Yeah.
You know, but it's something that you have to buy this journey. And props to Patrick Stewart for being able to sell it as well.
Yeah. And not only that, if this episode were not done well, you would be, like, counting the minutes until you can back to normal Picard. But this episode is so effective that you are actually feeling emotionally upset by the fact that Galen is being left behind, you know, and that this whole other life is just gone. And to me, that is just a sign of how brilliant an episode it is, and that you're more invested in seeing his alternate life than getting back to the crew.
So next up for me, Cam, this is one that, you know, a lot of Star Trek fans will say, how could you include this on a top 10 list? And a lot of fans will say, how could you not include this on a top 10 list? But I'm going with In the Pale Moonlight from Deep Space Nine, where I do understand the argument that people say, well, it doesn't live up to the ideals of Star Trek. For me, it's such a deconstruction and subversion of what Star Trek is that it actually works. But I think it works as a one-off. If every subsequent episode of Deep Space Nine was like this,
yeah,
I think this would be more of a jump the shark episode,
yeah,
for Star Trek Deep Space Nine. But I just keep going back to that confrontation between Sisko and Garak in the tailor shop after Sisko realizes that Garak was responsible for the bombing of the Romulan senator. And Garak's like, yeah, you're complicit with it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really what you wanted this whole time. Who did you think you were getting to bed with here, Ben?
Right.
And Ben's like, yeah, okay. I guess I have to live with that. But you brought up earlier about kind of Star Trek is not really known for its super dynamic storytelling when we were talking about in A Mirror Darkly.
Mm-hmm.
Think about just the format of this episode where we literally have Sisko doing an episode-long captain's log. And by the end of it, he is not quite breaking the fourth wall, but he's looking directly at the camera, deleting the log, cut to black, as opposed to just the regular credits as we see them. There's something just so, I guess, eye-catching and different and distinct about this one. But I am curious about your thoughts about whether you think this actually lives up to what Star Trek is, or if there's something that's, you know, doesn't quite work for you and you have a lot of problems with it like other fans would.
I don't have a problem with it. I think it does live up to what Star Trek is in the sense of, like, these characters should always be tackling the issues that they have to deal with. I think that's what makes Star Trek Star Trek to a big degree, is that these aren't characters who just make a flip decision and run with it, like action heroes or whatever. Like, this is an hour of Sisko grappling with a decision. And to me, that's pretty Star Trek-y.
I agree.
And, you know, yes, some viewers may not agree with the decision that he made, but ultimately you are going to see him work through the process of how he arrived at that decision. And most shows wouldn't do that. And I think what makes this hour just so incredible is that this feels like a turning point for Star Trek. The show, I think, was on a certain track for a long time, and this felt, you know, like one of the first episodes in, maybe the first episode in Deep Space Nine, where it really felt like they're like, we are shifting what audiences consider Star Trek. Not because we don't like what has come before, but because we have to. Because if this franchise is going to continue to wow people and pull them in, we've got to change a little bit of what's going on and draw people in. Because you can't surprise people if you're always delivering what they expect.
Well, exactly. If it's just the same resolution every single time, where at the end of it, Sisko gives a speech, says, but I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
And then what happens? The Dominion takes over? But it's kind of like, you know, if you're painted into a corner, what would you do? And look, I don't think Picard would have come to the same conclusion as Sisko.
No.
But we're not watching Star Trek Picard.
Right.
Not yet, anyway.
And it is a show about humanity. And we are seeing a human being make a decision and having to live with it, as he says, at the very end.
But then let's debate that a little bit, because the Roddenberry ideal is that humanity has evolved. And I do believe that Roddenberry would not have approved of Sisko's decision.
Yeah.
But guess what? Star Trek is there to change and evolve. And so that I'm not so hung up about what Roddenberry's vision would have been for Ben Sisko at that point. But the idea is humanity maybe should not be making those kinds of decisions. But I think that, like, honestly, painted into a corner, yeah, I mean, this is why I like Star Trek, because you get to debate the philosophical and moral underpinnings of what the characters are doing here. And it is, like you said, kind of boring if every, you know, episode is just the characters pontificating to you about why they're making the right decision. And Star Trek's telling you this is the right decision. It's not up for debate. It's not up for you to figure it out on your own. It's like, here's what we believe is right. And it's kind of like, it's a little nausea-inducing at a certain time.
Sure, but you can also argue that it very much is Star Trek in that, does Sisko make the right decision? I mean, maybe not, but he is going to live with it. And so we can see, essentially, how this decision is going to impact him. You know, it's always about striving forward and improving yourself, but maybe Sisko didn't do that. Maybe he did make a mistake, but he's not being let off scot-free either. Like, you can see that this is something he's going to carry with him the rest of his life. It's not a decision he chose, and he's like, yep, good to go.
I mean, the rest of his life until he gets into the fire caves?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Wow. What's on your list, Cam?
Okay, well, next up. Okay, so Star Trek, I think, doesn't get enough points for how fun it can be. And a lot of the episodes I've picked on my list so far, and some of the ones you picked as well, like...
Oh, wait, you brought up Chain of Command.
I know, that's the most fun one. Yeah. But, you know, they all have fun moments in them. Yeah. There's lots of...
There's a lot in Chain of Command.
That Gal Madrid is a real cut-up.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, we haven't really mentioned any episodes that are just pure fun from beginning to end. Although, you know, Mirror Darkly is kind of close.
I think in a Mirror Darkly is that episode.
It's probably the closest.
It,
but
it is for me.
So I've got Trials and Tribulations in next. Now, I really struggled between The Trouble with Tribbles and Trials and Tribulations. But I ultimately went with the DS9 one because, to me, the level of invention going on in this episode is just shocking. But, I mean, it is so ambitious.
And I think it maybe goes back to the point I was making about In the Pale Moonlight, where it's almost a deconstruction of an episode of Star Trek and then rebuilding it in a way that makes you rethink everything that came before.
Yeah.
And makes it, much like the In the Mirror Darkly example, it's such a fan servicey episode that actually works, where there's so many fan servicey examples where you're like, oh man, am I just going to be groaning this entire time? This one is so fantastic and so delightful.
And this could have easily just been a technical exercise, like how well can we blend original footage with DS9 footage?
Yeah.
And hey, we might have mentioned it as like, oh, that was a really well done episode technically. But to me, this has so much heart and so much of that original series spirit. You know, you have that moment at the end where Sisko is on the bridge with Kirk, and you get an emotional response to that. Like, you feel moved for Sisko having this experience. And it also showcases Kirk in a way where you're just like, man, you have a certain amount of wonder for that original series crew. I've always thought Star Trek has done a really, really good job at shining this very fond light at the original series and presenting it in a way that feels wondrous, even if you don't like that show.
But it's also good that they don't go to that well too often.
Yeah, definitely not.
Yeah. I also, the moment that you brought up, it's probably my favorite moment, like the one on the bridge that came throughout this episode. And for me, it's one of the few times we really do see Sisko with his guard down and just geeking out, and it humanizes him as well, which is something that I love.
Well, it doesn't feel like just broad comedy. Like, all of the characters are behaving as we would expect these characters to behave. You know, Jadzia, you know, geeking out over Spock is... great, and you can totally see Jadzia behaving like this. Or
Bashir debating whether or not he needs to sleep with his potential grandmother.
Classic Bashir.
Yeah.
You know, and just O'Brien sort of being gruff and wanting to get out of there.
No, O'Brien saying, hey, look, it's Kirk. He's pointing at Kirk's stunt double.
Yeah, right.
Like, it's so hilarious. There's so many great moments.
And you get a great canon moment like Worf saying, we don't discuss, you know, the forehead ridges when the original series Klingon show up. And to me, it's just so much fun, just so incredibly well done, and bringing back Arne Darvin and things like that, just incredible.
I hope Discovery brings Arne Darvin back at least once more.
Is that actor still alive?
Well, they don't necessarily need the same actor. I don't think they're bringing back...
He might be, I don't know.
Sean Kenny to play Captain Pike.
Right.
So, but I
would love it if they did, though.
But I was thinking more about, like, I think you could actually introduce Arne Darvin at a certain point where, okay, but the one issue is, like, the audience knows that he's a Klingon agent at this point. The crew doesn't, so it kind of makes the crew look like dopes unwittingly to a certain degree. It'd be okay if we saw, I don't know, maybe Ash Tyler have like an excursion with a recast Arne Darvin, though.
Or just a reference that they were being transformed at the same time or something like that. I don't know.
That'd be great.
Or he met Arne Darvin in the recruitment center, something like that. Although, I mean, what's Arne Darvin's real name?
Laurel.
Spoiler.
Yeah. Right. Next on my list, Cam, Tapestry. I think this is such an incredible Q showcase, of course, but I just think about, you know, the fact that it does three great things. Yeah, I mentioned the Q moments, like Jean Luc Picard, or him just right. caressing Picard's face when Picard awakes from his, I guess, one night stand with his best buddy.
Right.
We also have the kind of the time travel world building that I really like when you've got the old school uniforms that Picard's wearing on mm-hmm. this very alien sort of outpost. And then finally, we get to go to that butterfly effect when we're back on the Enterprise. And we see what a man who is thinking, hey, can I solve my past mistakes? And he sees what the end result of that. And that's not great. It's right. something like, you know what? Maybe instead of trying to fix all my flaws, I need to kind of conquer them over a span of a lifetime. And it's actually a good lesson for mm-hmm. like anybody to take away.
Yeah.
You know, I would love to go correct all the mistakes I've made, but...
Like starting this podcast?
I know. 200 episodes later, I had no idea that's what I was getting myself in for. But to me, there's something about that moment where we see Picard as a junior grade lieutenant in the blue uniform, and yeah. it's such an amazing shorthand
yeah.
for how his life turned out over the next, say, 30, 35 years in Starfleet.
Right.
To me, I think that this is a great, I guess, existential journey for Picard, where you mentioned Inner Light as well, where taking Picard out of his comfort zone is always fun to do mm-hmm. and giving it some emotional heft and also just kind of the sci-fi tropes that go along with it.
Yeah.
It's a pretty great one.
This is one of my favorite Q episodes. I'm a big fan of when they use Q in more of a serious way, where he really is digging into Picard or humanity in some interesting way.
Yeah.
I'm not as big a fan of, you know, goofy Q showing up. There's a couple good ones, but a lot of time it feels pretty lightweight stuff. This is such a great story, and, you know, it actually goes very well with, like, all good things and the idea of examining, you know, alternate realities and yep. what could happen with Picard's life.
You bring up the all good things comparison, and it's funny in that all good things didn't feel like there's a lot of similarities between the two, but it didn't feel as if all good things was being derivative at all, which is interesting that they're able to kind of take a very similar sort of idea that, you know, it's not beyond Q to do this to Picard, but still make it unique. And, I appreciate both of them for what they're able to accomplish in their respective episodes.
Right. Well, Tapestry is very like A Christmas Carol or It's a Wonderful Life. Whereas, like, All Good Things is not. It's yes. definitely a different type of story, but they have a similar sort of conceptual idea.
All right, sir, what's next on your list?
Okay, well, last on my list is The Visitor from Deep Space Nine. I referenced this episode a little while back. To me, this is just the most profoundly moving Star Trek episode ever filmed. There's other ones maybe I like more, maybe not. We'll see when we get the final list, but... Tony Todd's performance in this episode as the older Jake and recounting... you know, the loss of his father and having Sisko pop up through these various key moments through Jake's life. It's just astonishingly powerful stuff. Father-son relationships are done on film, I mean, a lot. You know, forget the mother-daughter stuff. That's often, you know, a lot less of those stories are being made than the father-son stuff. But to me, this is probably the best one in all of Star Trek and the one that I think is in many ways the most relatable. Now, we haven't all had our fathers disappear and then reappear every handful of years.
In a warp core accident.
Yeah, in a warp core accident. But more about the emotions attached to it and how you want them to be there for those important moments of your life and what happens when they're gone.
And we also bring up just kind of the emotional heft that goes with this one. And, I mean, it is a tragic story because Jake Sisko would have been better off had his father just died. His life would have been better off. His marriage would not have fallen apart. He would have been able to pursue his passion as a writer. He would have been tortured and traumatized by his father's death. But I think it's even more traumatizing to hang on to this hope and know that it's possible to get him back until he finally realizes the only way to do so is to end his own life. And that's just such an emotional gut punch. I remember... watching it. So my own experience watching it is like the week before you had the explosive return of Worf in Way of the Warrior.
Yeah.
And I was like, can't wait to see what Deep Space Nine has next. And then it opens with a rainy old man, Jake Sisko.
They definitely did not know what they had.
Oh, okay. That's the thing. I think they knew what they had when they got the script for, say, The Inner Light.
Sure.
This one, I don't think they did. I think they were genuinely surprised by the reaction from fans.
I think this was an episode like yesterday's Enterprise where they're like, oh, we don't know. You know, hopefully this turns out good. And then it turns into like a favorite of the fans. And to me, like, this is one of the very few that will actually make me, like, tear up watching it. And it's done it every time I've watched it. So that, to me, is a real sign that it is just incredibly well-done storytelling.
I know other Deep Space Nine episodes had been built up to you before you saw them. Was this one kind of spoiled for you? Did you know what you were getting?
I didn't really know about this one in advance. Yeah. No, not at all. Which, you know, maybe worked out better. Just this one really snuck up on me, and I was completely blown away by it.
I think this one snuck up on a lot of people. And the fact that even last year at the big Las Vegas convention, they had a panel dedicated to... Or was it last year or the year before, Cam?
I think it was the year before. Yeah.
Okay, but they had an entire panel dedicated to kind of looking at the resonance behind this moment.
Right.
And it's a very special episode, even if it's a bit of a fluke.
Right.
But, I mean, it comes down to, I think, a lot of, like, Tony Todd carrying this. Mm-hmm. And I'm just kind of, I'm still blown away by everything that they did here.
And a lot of people make fun of the character of Jake Sisko on the show. But I think when you look at episodes like Explorers or their interactions in The Emissary and, you know, various episodes through the show, it shows how important that relationship is to Sisko, and that it is one of the best real life relationships we see written on Star Trek. Like, it doesn't feel heightened in a way a lot of the other great ones do. Like, I love Jadzia and Worf, but it doesn't necessarily feel as
something you can relate to.
Yeah, as relatably quote unquote human as a story like this, where, you know, when I get to this episode, this is like paying off all those years of building up their relationship, and it does it so beautifully. And you end up carrying the emotions of this episode right to the end of the series. Because a lot of the episodes, when you get to like season 6 and 7, Sirach Lofton isn't there. But I feel like this episode elevates their relationship so high that when he is popping in during the, you know, near the end of the series, it's like you are still carrying the weight of that relationship based on that episode.
Well, would the pullback shot from What You Left Behind, mm-hmm. would it have worked as well had there not been such a buildup with regards right. to the relationship, especially with an episode like this?
Yeah, where you're seeing what happens when he loses Sisko from his life, and he ultimately does.
Yeah. So it's kind of a, Jake's got a secretly tragic sort of character arc that's, you know, he loses his mother, and then he loses his father, at least for this timeline.
Right.
And then he loses his father again in the Prime timeline as well.
Yeah.
So maybe we're due for a Jake Sisko dissection episode, Cam.
I thought you were going to say a spinoff series like Captain Picard.
I can't wait. Yeah. So the last one on my list here is Yesterday's Enterprise. And we've talked a lot about alternate timelines, and what I find it is often when we see them on Star Trek, they can be hard to invest in. The ones that we've talked about so far today, they've actually been quite successful at this.
Right.
But I think this is also kind of almost a writer's redemption story about like how to handle a character like Tasha Yar.
Yeah.
Where, you know, they knew that they kind of failed that character in the way that she was dispatched. So
what are you talking about, Tyler?
Yeah. So how can they go forward and give her the send-off that she really deserves in a kind of an honorable way?
Yeah.
Beyond that, though, I mean, what if alternate characters can actually have a bit of a direct impact on the Prime characters that we're following? Because we do know that this is going to have an impact on our own universe or mm-hmm. the Star Trek Prime universe as well. And you also wonder, well, are they going to make the right decision that the Picard that I know and care about would make, even after he's been kind of a war captain for however number of years they've been at it with the Klingons? The moment that really gets me every time, though, is when Picard says, the war's been going very bad for us, and we've kept it secret, but it's going very bad. And I'm just like, yes, it feels scary. You've established the stakes. I buy what's going on. Also think about the Picard and Guinan dynamic here, where mm-hmm. Guinan's like, you just have to trust me. Picard says, how can you expect me to do that? And she's like, I don't know. But he does, ultimately. And that, to me, is very much like I can relate to that relationship, and I believe in that relationship in this alternate universe as much as I do in the Prime timeline as well. And like you said just a second ago, Cam, the fact that this kind of sprang out of nowhere, they thought it was going to be a total disaster that no one would be able to follow, and became one of the most iconic Star Trek episodes of all time. Look, thank the universe for small mistakes, I suppose.
I mean, to this day, Jonathan Frakes is like, I don't get that episode.
Yeah.
It's so interesting how people involved with it can still be like, I don't get it.
Jonathan Frakes directing two episodes of The Orville this coming season on Fox.
Yesterday's Enterprise is so great, too, for the introduction of Richard Castillo as well. Like another character like Shelby or Jellico, who feels fully formed, or even Rachel Garrett as well. Like these aren't characters who feel like they're just tossed in as bit players of the week. Like they feel like they have a life and that, you know, they've had an experience with their crews. And you're being kind of tossed in and joining them, but they don't feel like newbies where you're kind of like, who is this character? How do I, you know, what's their quirks? How long do I have to wait to care about them? Like, they only have a short amount of time to make you care about those characters, and they pull it off.
Well, it's fantastic how often Star Trek's able to do that in 45 minutes. We've gone through all these great episodes, and you'd hope that, yes, if they're the greatest episodes of all time, that they would be successful at making us care about these characters and storylines. But Star Trek's got a pretty good track record of making these little mini movies that you know are able to accomplish so much in which a lot of films can't do with given three times the amount of screen time.
You go right back to the beginning with the cage and you have like the Vina character who you actually have an emotional response to seeing, you know, what's going to happen with her and her tragic backstory. So it shows that like right from the get-go, that was very much, I think, a goal of the series was to not have just bit players of the week. Like a lot of say like the Western shows did at that era where it's like, you know, who's showing up and needs help this week.
Right.
It feels like with Star Trek, they were making mini movies and they wanted you to feel like a certain sweep with these characters where you really got wrapped up in their stories in a way that, I mean, I've watched a lot of shows from the 60s as well, you know, non-Star Trek shows, and they don't have the level of depth with their supporting characters that they're bringing in for guest appearances that Star Trek does.
I don't know. There's pretty good episodes of Dick Van Dyke.
Sure.
Sure. Okay. Anyway. So, guys, we've gone through all of our episodes, and I know some listeners are like, how could you not include life support, or you know, this one, or
Sub Rosa,
you know, this one or that one. We will have some honorable mentions in just a moment, but now we're actually going to go through our rankings, and then maybe you and I can nudge each other, make fun of each other a little bit about why this episode's ranked higher than that one. But how do we want to do this, Cam? Do you want to do your number 10 and I'll do my number 10, or do you want to go straight through?
Why don't we go through our list individually so people can kind of keep track of where we were mentally when we were putting these lists together. Okay. I think if we bounce back and forth, they'll be like, wait, what was number 9 on whose list?
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, so why don't you go first?
Sure. Number 10, In a Mirror Darkly. Maybe not a surprise that's the one Enterprise episode of my list is at the bottom of the list, but still such a great one. Number 9, Tapestry. Might be the best Q episode, might be the second best Q episode.
Okay.
Hint, hint. Number 8, Yesterday's Enterprise. Number 7, my one entry for the original series, City on the Edge of Forever. Number 6, The Inner Light. So now we're getting into my top 5 here. Number 5, it's a Deep Space Nine episode. It's The Visitor. You mentioned it as well. It was on my list too. Number 4, and it's funny you brought this up, Cam. You said The Best of Both Worlds Part 1, and I said Part 1 as well, even though I included In a Mirror Darkly Parts 1 and 2, because I 100% agree with you that the two-parter for Best of Both Worlds, it is weakened by the much, I don't want to say worse, but much less successful conclusion.
Well, it's a plot-driven conclusion as opposed to a character-driven one.
Exactly.
And ultimately, I almost left off Best of Both Worlds from my list because of that. Altogether, I almost let Part 2 drag Part 1 off my list.
I was never going to do that.
Oh, well.
Yeah. Number 3, Call to Arms. Number 2, In the Pale Moonlight, very DS9 heavy.
Yeah.
Ultimately, Cam, number 1, in something that's it's predicated on so much of what we've journeyed with the characters that we know so well, but I have to give it to All Good Things. This is an episode that I'm happy to give to a novice who's maybe not super familiar with them. They'll follow this. They'll understand why people like Star Trek. And also, I'll happily watch this one with any huge Star Trek fan anytime, and we can discuss everything that went on. The episode's 90 minutes long. We could debate it for like 3 hours, which we did on one podcast as well. I think that's like number 101 or 99 or something like that.
Right.
So, Cam, let's go through your top 10.
Okay, so for my list, at number 10, I had Call to Arms. At number 9, I had In the Pale Moonlight. Number 8, I had Trials and Tribulations. So we're on a DS9 run there with the bottom 3. Number 7, I have Chain of Command Part 2. Number 6, I have Best of Both Worlds Part 1. Number 5, I have Corbomite Maneuver from the original series. Number 4, I have Balance of Terror. Number 3, The Inner Light. Number two, The Visitor. And number one, City on the Edge of Forever.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So we did have a fair amount of crossover, which is to be expected, but a couple differences as well. So if you want to get into our honorable mentions, it's interesting because maybe I can, you know, a couple that you would have included, like, say, Chain of Command, that would have made it on my honorable mention. So maybe I can sneak in a couple other ones that didn't necessarily make this list here. Some of the honorable mentions that you had included on your list. I totally had Trials and Tribulations as well, but I also want to bring up a few other ones. I am kind of bummed that we didn't include so much Voyager, and by so much.
I felt bad about that.
I meant any. There are two episodes that do stand out to me, and they kind of go back to this emotional resonance I had watching both of them. Someone to Watch Over Me.
Right.
That was the episode of Voyager that kind of hit me emotionally more than any other one that I ever saw.
Mm-hmm.
The other one, and I know you might cringe at this, but for me, it was Tinker Tenor, Dr. Spy.
Right.
This is one where I saw Star Trek, and for the first time, I was laughing out loud more than just once or twice in one episode. To me, there's just so many like funny things, like that whole conference room scene where they're all making eyes at the doctor.
Right.
And you're
what
is going on here? It like I was legit like laughing. Like I feel like that's probably like the funniest episode of Star Trek of all time.
Other than Spirit Folk.
Yeah. that's not funny, Cam. Don't joke about that. So I do have some Voyager mentions here. Another one, I did have Mirror Mirror for TOS. I was wondering, you know, how is going to wedge TOS in. Ultimately, I had to go with City on the Edge of Forever. Another one, mine was so TNG heavy, so I was, I'm not going to feel bad, but Darmok.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, that's such a that is Star Trek: The Next Generation, and that might be a good one for like another beginner's guide, one that we may do down the road as well. So, yeah, to me, those are kind of the honorable mentions that I said. Look, listeners, I know there's some missing on the list here, but trust me, I appreciate them all.
Yeah, I mean, I almost had All Good Things on my list. Like, it was so close. There was a couple that got jockeyed around a lot, but All Good Things and Yesterday's Enterprise were both on that list. Ultimately, I just went with the 10 I went with, but they were really close. I also had a couple Voyager ones that, I mean, one in particular that bounced on and off of my list a lot, and ultimately Call to Arms took number 10, but Blink of an Eye almost joined the list. Because Blink of an Eye is an episode that I was profoundly just like moved by watching. Yeah. And that's the episode, of course, where Voyager encounters that planet that is aging at a very fast rate. So they're watching the entire evolution of a species just from space. And to me, this episode just floored me when I saw it. I think it is the greatest Voyager episode, I think.
I can totally see an argument for that.
Yeah, and just I had that real like feeling of inspiration watching it. That sense of like discovery that Star Trek, I think, does when it's really firing on all cylinders, where you really feel like inspired to experience, you know, new frontiers. Someone to Watch Over Me was also on my list. The other one that jumped out was I had The Trouble with Tribbles, because I did jockey between that and Trials and Tribulations. But the one that actually maybe is a little bit of a sentimental favorite, but I do think it belongs on a best, say, 20 or something like that, maybe a 15, is The Offspring from Next Generation. That is an episode that I found just incredible. Hayley Todd playing Data's daughter.
Yeah.
I know people usually say Measure of a Man is the greatest Data story. I might say that The Offspring is. I think it has more of an emotional, you know, sucker punch to it.
Yeah.
I think Hayley Todd is brilliant on that episode. And just all of the arguments taking place, maybe with the exception of that Admiral is kind of a jackass, I think that people have interesting perspectives. You know, Picard, you could easily look at him in another show as like the boo hiss, like this guy's a jerk. But I like that he's struggling with his decision as to what to do about Data's daughter. And he all actively works his way through it over the course of that episode.
The next best Data episode, of course, is where he encounters Dr. Sung's android wife.
Well, obviously,
yeah.
Don't they take on the the crystalline entity or something?
Yeah. Do you remember how he figures out it's her or that she's an android?
No, I don't.
He listens to her play the violin once.
Oh, that's right.
And then he listens to her do it again, and it's exactly the same.
That's kind of clever.
It is, but it's just kind of like it's also kind of dopey. But
you know, it is noteworthy. We didn't have any Data episodes on our list, and Data usually is regarded as, you know, maybe not Picard level, but maybe next in the popularity list.
We had a lot of Riker episodes on our list. And to me, I keep saying this, but like if you go back and you watch TNG all the way through, he is 100% number two amongst the cast. Like he is, you know, there's a reason why he's second billed. Like he is, after Picard, the next most important character. I realize Data is maybe a more popular or iconic character. Data did not have nearly as much to do throughout the run of TNG as Riker did. And
right.
I think maybe our list kind of reflects it as well.
Yeah.
So,
but I do think the Offspring is one of his most powerful hours.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
So, Cam, we've had, about 100 episodes to reflect since our last 100 episode extravaganza.
Yeah.
Cam, are there a few episodes that struck you where you just had fun listening to it, or you had fun recording it, researching it, or the guest was on fire? Just what maybe stands out to you a little bit over the last, 100 episodes that we've done?
Yeah, I've got a mix of episodes that I think are really important to our podcast, and just some that I just had a blast doing. There are certain episodes we do that I think are important in terms of the canon of our start, the Subspace Universe podcast catalog, and that maybe they're not my favorite ones to sit and do all the research for, because some of them are a lot of research, but I feel like they have to be done. And they deserve to be kind of locked into that canon. Like, we've done episodes like Andorians or Tellarites or like the evolution of Klingons. I feel like episodes like that are very important. And
we were tackling aliens at a certain point, and we didn't quite get how to do it initially. Yeah. I remember the Cardassians was our first shot at doing it.
Right.
And maybe I wish we could go back and redo that one, because we finally realized we kind of need to tackle them in a certain episode-by-episode sort of structure as opposed to going all over the place. And so when I think we finally figured out what the format was with probably the Klingons, where we realized we needed to go and look at these big turning points for their evolution as a species, like the important episodes that really changed the way that we perceived them or how they were introduced to the franchise. Yeah. So,
but when I was going through the list of like those important episodes to me, I look at the Evolution of Q episode we did with Patrick Johnston, which was just so much fun. I think that was maybe the best example of those episodes we've done, where we're tackling all the important points as to what makes this character important and how he's changed over time. But also bringing, I think, a lot of the humor that we've tried to instill in this podcast and bring to it.
Emphasis on tried.
Tried and failed miserably. Yeah. But and just having that good banter between, in that case, the three of us, enjoying these Q episodes and pointing out what works about them and what really doesn't work about some of them.
Yeah, for me, I'm thinking back 50 episodes ago. It's actually episode 150. And it is The Beginner's Guide to Star Trek.
That's on my list as well, yeah.
That was such a fun one to do, where we literally just selected a whole bunch of episodes and introduced them to your sister, who's always been kind of, I wouldn't say resistant, but she hasn't been like a huge Star Trek fan the way that you are.
Right.
And we kind of did a point tally, and we kept it a secret who picked which episode. And ultimately, like, she distributed points based on who guessed correctly which episode she would appreciate or like more. So we had so much fun. That is such a fun episode to listen to as well. And just her insights as kind of a non-fan into what works and what doesn't work, and maybe her journey going forward with Star Trek. And it's just interesting to me that she really latched onto Janeway of all the characters.
Definitely, yeah. So. And we don't have the same relationship with the podcast that the listeners do, where, some of the episodes that come out that people really enjoy, I sit there and go like, oh man, that was a lot of work. And like when we were recording, I was flipping through notes, and it was kind of a little bit stressful trying to keep the ball rolling. That was not the case with that one. That one was just a complete joy to record. And when I was listening back and editing it, I was just like, man, this is so much fun. And I still enjoy listening to that one. I've listened to that one, a few times. Normally, I often don't go back after I edit them, because I sit there and go through them bit by bit. And then I'm like, okay, let it go into the world and let me know how it is. That was definitely on the list of the ones that I have revisited.
I've listened to it twice. It's just that good.
Yeah.
So episode 150, people.
Speaking of episodes, that were a lot of work, but turned out far better than I ever expected, I may argue this is the best episode we've ever done. And that is number 157, the Dominion War episode, 20 years later, with David Boris, where we went through the Dominion War arc from Deep Space Nine. And going into that one, I think I had similar expectations as like our Evolution of Q or Evolution of, these like the Klingons or something like that. And I walked out of it just like, wow, I really think we nailed that one. Like I really, and David Boris was a huge, huge part. Don't give either of us the credit, and I sure don't.
No, I said even on the show, he's far more articulate with regards to his thoughts on Star Trek than I ever will be.
But I really did feel like he, really helped us nail down what you know, what matters about that arc. And we kind of got a lot of great discussion out of it. And yeah. I was kind of wowed by it. Like, I walked out of the episode going, like, you know, if we could have episodes like that every week where I really felt like we left everything on the table about a topic, because so often we record these, and then after the fact, I'll be like, why didn't I mention this or that? You know, but that was a case where I really felt like, I think we left it all out there.
It's pretty exhaustive, just like how the Dominion War shook out and actually how it played out with regards to the impacts that it would have on Deep Space Nine, as well as the rest of the franchise. And maybe in Las Vegas, Cam, when we do our panel at the big convention this coming August, we can go into even more detail as we will be tackling how storytelling has evolved throughout all of Star Trek. So that'll be a fun follow-up there.
Right.
And here's one where I really don't know what fans think of these sort of excursions, but for me, while they're recording it, nothing is more fun than doing the Klingon Bloodline games, which you are like the kind of the host slash quizmaster for. We get a group of our friends together from Las Vegas, and we just, I mean, you're doing trivia. You are asking us to do impressions of characters, or at least make us, Cam, like, make a justification for a certain character's existence, like one Vedic Varial or Mr. Hom or something like that.
Mirror Universe Jennifer Sisko.
Like, okay. And you know, these are just such a hoot to do. And when I listen back to them, they sound like we're conveying how much fun it is in the room.
Right.
Number 105, Klingon Bloodline games from Las Vegas in 2016. That was just such a blast to do. And like, Cam, my hats off to you for just pulling that all together. You make it seem easy, but I know for a fact, I mean, that you do put a lot of hard work and thought into that. So
they're very stressful actually to actually do, but we'll have one this year.
Nice.
So I'm looking forward to that, and I have to get started on it because time is running out.
Yeah, it's true. You and I should really figure out that panel that we're going to
no kidding.
Doing. Yeah.
The last one I have listed here is, I really enjoy episodes where we're kind of doing goofy stuff on the show. You know, when you're doing something like the Dominion War, there's a lot of humor in that episode, and there's some really funny moments that Dave helped us come up with. But ultimately, like, some of the most fun episodes to sit down for, and sometimes the ones that don't turn out great are the ones where it's like, here's a funny concept, this will be a blast for an hour, and we can all have lots of laughs. A couple that really worked well was our best worst episodes, where we pointed out like some of the episodes of Star Trek that are just terrible that we can't stop obsessing over and falling in love with. And we talked about episodes like Spock's Brain and The Children Shall Lead and Sub Rosa and Bound, episodes like that, and just, I think, had a complete riot and reenacted moments from them. And to me, those are just a total blast. And I think they actually play well as, you know, not just in the room recording them, but also listening to them back.
We've had listeners comment on the Sub Rosa transcript that you and I read back and forth, which is pretty fun to do.
Yeah, we also did a recreation of Bound as well with the weightlifting scene,
Yeah, so lots of good times there as well. That was a fun one too. So this one, you know, just from, I guess, my own fan experience, it was such a surreal moment sitting down to watch The Vulcan Hello and Battle at the Binary Stars.
Right.
Since it had been almost 15 years since Star Trek was on the air. I remember you and I was playing a prank on you, Cam. I told you I had a bottle of vodka and I was going to take a shot every single time there was a reference to the original series.
Yeah.
And listeners, the vodka is filled with water. Cam did not know that.
And Cam doesn't drink at all.
He doesn't drink at all. So Cam just sees me just like shooting back all these shots of vodka over the course of 2 hours. And the deal is we're going to have to go record immediately after that. And I think you said later on, after you found out that it was all a joke, in your head, you're like, oh man, I'm going to have to like really carry this one.
Right.
And I think you also were thinking to yourself, well, that really wasn't a reference. That's a bit of a stretch there. He must really just want to drink.
I don't know if a transporter is a reference to the original series. Yeah.
So I had fun just sitting through that experience because we did not know what to expect. We didn't know what it was going to be like. And it was just kind of an amazing experience to sit down and just talk about Star Trek on air for the very first time in like 13 years, which was just, or 12 years, which is just like crazy to think about.
Yeah, and we knew that episode was going to do better than the usual episode of Subspace.
Sure, yeah.
Just because of the fact it was new Star Trek, and it was definitely a very, very, very popular episode. And so when you were sitting there doing shots, I was like, oh my God, he's going to torpedo us in front of more people than usual. I mean, I'm used to being humiliated in front of a, you know, group of people, a large number of people, but in that case, I was particularly concerned.
But yeah, I mean, that's like kind of a good one to, because it was also just kind of we've done the two-part episode analyses before, but this is the first time that we're doing Star Trek week to week, and it's such a different kind of format than we usually do, so it was kind of fun to just shake things up at like what episode 170 something, you know, and you're like, wow, we're doing something incredibly different. The franchise is changing quite significantly. Based on Alex Kurtzman's new contract, it's going to be changing even more. Which, if we think about the next 100 episodes, Cam, I really truly wonder what's in store for Star Trek. Because I think when we did those first 100 episodes, Star Trek was at a bit of a low point with regards to its standing in pop culture. I mean, we had the J.J. Abrams movies.
Trek Beyond was really the only interesting thing. I don't even think that was in the first 100.
No, that
I don't
was,
think we had anything.
No, Star Trek Beyond, I think, was 130 or something that. Yeah, so
we really didn't have anything in that first 100.
We had nothing.
Maybe like some Blu-ray releases, things like that, but not much.
Yeah, so it's going to be amazing to think that pretty soon we're going to have more Star Trek content coming out on your streaming services than we've seen since the 1990s, which is just incredible to think. It's going to be a good problem for us to have if that means more work to do or more reviews to give to listeners. But we just want everybody to keep tuning in. Like, tell your friends about it if you like this. You know, just let them know that, I don't know, we kind of take a different approach to podcasting.
Yeah.
I think really the audiences that we care most about is just you and I amusing each other.
Sure.
Which obviously annoys a lot of our other friends and other people that know us, and they have to sit through us banter. But, I mean, this has been just a great 200 episodes to do with you, sir. So
it's been an absolute blast. I mean, I never would have dreamed it would go this long. You know, we started with Benjamin Yong. We didn't really know where it was going, and I never dreamed it would go to 200. I think the first time I really figured, though, that there was something going on was in episode 12 when we did Musical Moments. Mm. And I was suddenly like, oh, there's like potential for this to keep going. I think we've maybe hammered down what an episode of this podcast is.
The only problem was that was Benjamin Yong's last episode, I guess he did not see any sort of potential that you saw there.
No, I guess not. I guess not. Well, maybe we'll get him back for number 300.
I like how we've got this fella who was on 188 episodes ago as a regular host, and we still reference him. So.
I know. Well,
we're still friends with him.
We've been referencing Vedic Braille since episode 3.
Yeah, speaking of which, there's a bit of Vedic Braille news, which
for the first time ever.
Which I never thought I'd say, but it had to happen on the week that we're recording 200 episode, but Gizmodo recently had an article all about how Vedic Braille had to be the most boring Star Trek action figure ever produced. And immediately after that article came out, we had one listener, Audrey Nguyen, she immediately messaged us about that. We also had people posting on Facebook. Mark Bagnall, he immediately messaged us. We also had like one of our previous guests, Jara Hodge, she was messaging us. I like how we've become kind of the Vedic Braille guys.
It's my proudest achievement out of this whole podcast.
Well, that's just it. Like, I was posting on our Facebook page, like, hey, any excuse for me to share Cam's Vedic Braille music video?
Right.
I am there. I'm all about that. Because that Vedic Braille music video rap is one of the greatest things we've ever seen. So it's pretty cool to think that if there's one thing after 200 episodes that we've become known for, it's as the Vedic Braille fans?
I guess. I'll take it.
I'll take it, yeah. Kim, when did we start talking about Vedic Braille?
It was in episode 3. We did best and worst recurring guest characters.
So,
and I brought him up as an example of the worst from Deep Space Nine, because we went series by series, and he was my pick. And I remember at the time, both you and Ben were kind of like, oh yeah, him. Like, there was no sense of like, oh yeah, Vedic. And then it just turned into Vedic Braille jokes on a regular basis, and it just built and built and built. So, I don't know.
197 episodes later.
I know. But, like, some of our friends now make Vedic Braille jokes to us.
Yeah.
You know, so.
We're literally posting photos of us on social media holding our Vedic Braille action figures, which we literally own. It wasn't just this Gizmodo article that sent us to the stores. And believe me, not many stores still carry Vedic Braille action figures.
But they should.
They should. And but, we're taking photos of ourselves with our Vedic Braille action figures, complete with a Pog and a candlestick holder.
One of my great regrets in all of my years of going to conventions is that I've never gotten to see Philip Anglim at a convention.
Yeah, we actually...
I would do that photo op in a second.
Well, I remember a couple years ago, I was posting on like one of the Facebook groups about whether Philip Anglim would ever come to a convention, and the former president of his fan club said he never would.
There was like weird sort of details. I don't know if they're accurate at all, but it was kind of like this excuse as to why he'd never do it. And it was like, oh, like I was really bummed about that.
Yeah,
because, you know, what a great idea for him to come to one of these cons, and... I would just do the photo. I'd probably get an autograph as well. Like, I would make the most out of my Vedic Barayal experience.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. Well, we'll see. Maybe for the, 53rd or 52nd or something. Okay. I would have thought this would have been the year, though, for the anniversary of Deep Space Nine.
You'd hope, you know.
You'd hope they'd stack up the DS9 guest stars this year, but it doesn't look like they're going to.
You know what, Philip Anglim, I'll see you at number 100.
Yeah.
That's what it'll be.
Okay, so on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Cam, Section 31, Tal Shiar, Obsidian Order, all the spy agencies throughout all of Star Trek, they've created kind of this lore all around them, and it looks as if Discovery wants to go even deeper into this with another return of Section 31. So we're going to do a little something I like to call The Spy Who Phased Me. We're going to have fun talking about these kind of deep cover operatives, these kind of spy agencies, how they work, whether they work within Star Trek, and what their ultimate fates seem to be going forward here in this universe.
Okay, well, that'll be a lot of fun. So you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in Visitor, is one of the best episodes, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's R-E-P, P as in Pale Moonlight, O-R-T-O-N.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.